Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, journalistic access to the unfolding crisis in Syria is dangerous and sparse. But that hasn't kept Western officials from insisting that the situation is black and white, with the Syrian regime of Bashar al-Assad, the bad actor, and rebel Syrian militias, the good guys. How accurate is that? We'll be joined by Khan Hallinan, former head of the journalism school at UC Santa Cruz and a columnist for Foreign Policy in Focus. Also on the show, gearing up to host the Olympic Games means ribbon cuttings at newly built venues and international media attention. It also means the redirection of public funds for private profit and the trashing of civil liberties. What if there's more downside than up in being an Olympic city? We'll talk to Tom Tresser of No Games Chicago about that. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at the week's press.
With the U.S. and Israel still mulling over when and how to attack Iran, media coverage continues to raise the stakes. On the March 5th broadcast of the ABC World News, anchor Diane Sawyer announced that Barack Obama and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu were talking about, quote, the growing nuclear threat from Iran, close quote. Sawyer warned that it might be the last chance for the two to meet face-to-face before a possible Israeli attack. Correspondent Jake Tapper explained that the two leaders are adamant that Iran, quote, cannot be allowed to develop a nuclear weapon, close quote. But what if Iran did? Here's how Tapper framed the issue.
What might result? A nuclear arms race in one of the most unstable parts of the world, an attack on Israel, and or terrorism.
Indeed, those terrifying worst-case scenarios could be three possibilities, but there's also at least one other possibility, that none of those things would happen. Tapper also explained that there could be downsides to an attack, high gas prices, for instance, and there could be more dangerous repercussions, too. ABC had former counterterrorism official Richard Clark explain that Iran could use the terror weapon to attack U.S. and Israeli interests throughout the world. This is the state of the Iran discussion. Powerful nations speak openly, in violation of international law, of launching an unprovoked attack on another country. Media speak about this as a matter of timing and logistics. But if Iran were to respond to an attack, well, that would be unleashing the terror weapon.
Those who suggest that outlets like the New York Times are left of center should read editorials like the one the paper ran on March 3rd more carefully. The paper is responding to evidence, much of it from AP, that the New York Police Department has been spying on and surveilling Muslims based solely on their religion with zero evidence of wrongdoing, systematically monitoring blogs of Muslim student groups at area colleges, taking pictures of mosque worshippers and Muslim-owned businesses, creating police records on individuals and groups, and all the while being very secretive about it. The presidents of Yale and Rutgers had no problem condemning the program, nor did Newark Mayor Cory Booker. Even New Jersey Governor Chris Christie criticized the program's overreach. But the most the supposedly leftist Times can bring itself to say is that while the NYPD was wise to beef up its counterterrorism efforts, quote, unfortunately, they did not provide for sufficiently strong supervision of this formidable and far-flung intelligence operation, close quote. Well, no, clearly. So what's the solution? In the paper's view, it's for the Justice Department to begin to review complaints about the program to determine whether an investigation is warranted. In other words, nothing urgent. New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg has flat out dismissed concerns about the program as ridiculous. The Times' response to that is to wonder what happened to the Bloomberg who once supported a proposed Muslim community center near Ground Zero, and to write, quote, we hope that mayor reemerges soon to restore trust, close quote. The Times laments what it claims is, quote, a distressing fact of life, that mistreatment of Muslims does not draw nearly the protest that it should, close quote. But surely the protest it should draw includes powerful media using their power for something more than calling for research to see if there should be research and hoping politicians will change their position.
Anderson Cooper hosted a Super Tuesday election night panel on CNN that promised, in the host's words, contributors on the left and right. On the right, former Bush spokesman Ari Fleischer and right-wing blogger Eric Erickson. On the left, frequent TV pundit and Democratic strategist Donna Brazile and Hillary Rosen. Rosen might be best known for her years at the Recording Industry Association of America, the music industry's lobbying powerhouse. She also briefly held the title of Washington editor-at-large for the Huffington Post. But the site cut ties with her in 2010 because she'd become a consultant for the oil company BP. You might recall they were in the news at the time, having spilled several million barrels of oil into the Gulf of Mexico. Rosen is apparently still the managing partner at the Brunswick Group, quote, an international corporate communications partnership that helps businesses and other organizations address critical communications challenges, close quote. Clients include major banks, energy companies, mining companies, and so on. Her day job is doing PR for large corporations, so naturally she plays the left on TV.
Mainstream pundits love to love so-called moderate Republicans. They seem to think it means they approve of moderation, but it plays out more as an approval of, well, Republicans. Frank Bruni's March 4th column in the New York Times contains the admission, quote, back in 1999, when I covered Congress, I had a kind of crush on Olympia Snow. Many of us in the Senate press gallery did, close quote. As Bruni tells it, it had something to do with the way Snow dared to disagree with her party, which is something pundits always say they want to see more of. But Snow's record on this count has been a bit exaggerated. As John Chait pointed out on New York Magazine's website, in reality, she often ended up arguing for minor tweaks to Republican policies. But Bruni's real point is that both sides are guilty of silencing their moderates. Quote, rare is the Democrat of plausible national ambition who tangles in a tough, meaningful way with labor unions or environmentalists, groups that President Obama has been loath to cross, close quote. Really? It seems likely that more labor or environmental advocates would question what Obama has done for them. So who does Bruni mean? Bill Clinton, who declared Arkansas a right-to-work state and passed NAFTA? As for Republicans, Bruni says, quote, rare is the Republican of plausible national ambition who doesn't kowtow to religious conservatives, close quote. Well, there's a lot more evidence of that phenomenon, as indeed Republicans are more apt to do what the party's conservative base wants them to do, while Democrats generally don't, leaving us with a two-party system where both parties have shifted to the right. And yet, pundits like Bruni decry both parties for moving in opposite directions and wish that Democrats would put even more distance between themselves and their party's progressive base. Because, you see, they like to be balanced.
And finally, there seems to be a popular line emerging in the Rush Limbaugh-Sandra Fluke controversy that says his comments are especially harmful because they distract attention from the real issues. As conservative columnist Kathleen Parker put it in the Washington Post on March 4th, quote, inadvertently, Limbaugh helped advance the argument from the left that Republicans are waging a war against women. He has given his feminazis justification for their claims that conservatives hate women. Close quote. According to conservative pundit Peggy Noonan on ABC's This Week, on March 4th, what Limbaugh said was destructive because, quote, it confused the issue. It played into this trope that the Republicans have a war on women. No, they don't, but he made it look that way, close quote. And the Washington Post's Sally Quinn, appearing on March 6th on the Fox News Channel, said that Obama had been given a huge gift by the Republicans, the religious right, and Rush Limbaugh, quote, because what he has done, what they have done, is managed to make the Republicans and the religious right look as though they are anti-woman, close quote. Of course, the other way of looking at this is that this is not a distraction, but an illustration of Republican policies that are anti-woman. To be fair, Quinn did mention that later as one possibility.
Thanks, Steve. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR.
It's unclear what's happening inside Syria, besides the fact that thousands have been killed over the last year. And while the situation, like any such conflict, is complicated, the various sides have rushed forth to provide their unique and simple versions of the truth. Our guest, Con Hallinan, a columnist with Foreign Policy in Focus, says there are two such central narratives put out about Syria today, and that while both have some truth, neither is reliable. He wrote about this in a March 5th Foreign Policy in Focus column, Solving Syria Requires Separating Myth from Reality. He joins us now from Berkeley, California. Welcome to Counterspin, Con Hallinan.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I wonder if you could give us, in a nutshell, what those two tales about Syria are and what you think of them.
Well, and the first one, and the one that I think most Americans get in our media, is that you have a rising by the vast majority of Syrians who are risen against a criminal dictatorship, that the government of Bashar al-Assad is essentially, its days are numbered. I think the president referred to Assad as a dead man walking. And that the only thing that is sort of keeping the whole thing from collapsing is the fact that the Russians and the Chinese vetoed a United Nations resolution that would have allowed basically the UN to intervene in the situation. That's the image that I think most Americans have of it, and then thousands, about 8,000 people have been killed over the past year. If you spin that around and you hear what the Syrians are saying, and not just the Syrians, because the Syrians do have support in places like Algeria and Lebanon and Iran and to a certain extent Jordan and Iraq and Russia and China, you have this kind of sinister alliance of the Gulf Cooperation Council, which is the feudal monarchies of the Gulf, NATO and the U.S., and also Al-Qaeda, which has sort of designated the Assad regime as the regime that it wants to overthrow. And the idea is that they're going to overthrow, this is an Islamicist attack, they're going to overthrow a secular regime and transform Damascus from a source of independence and anti-imperialism into a loyal ally of Washington and Saudi Arabia against Iran and Hezbollah. Now, those are the two stories, which you get one variety or other of both of them. And I think like most stories, you know, there's a certain amount of truth in both of them, and then there's a great deal of deception.
Since we're here in the West consuming Western media, let's focus on what you see as the faults of the Western version of what's going on in Syria.
Well, some of the charges that Syrians make are correct. I mean, there is a drive by the Gulf Cooperation Council, led by Saudi Arabia and Qatar, to overthrow the Assad regime. And one of the reasons why they want to overthrow it is because they see Syria as an important chess piece in a regional chess game against Iran. And so that, you know, it's not really about freedom and democracy. First of all, Saudi Arabia and Qatar are talking about freedom and democracy as a definition of irony. You know, it's about Iran. If you take a look at the statements by some of the Americans, senators, etc., all of them go back to say this would be an important step in isolating Iran. And you know, somehow, wait a minute, aren't there Syrians involved in this whole situation? So that part is legit. I mean, the Syrians have a legitimate complaint there. The other thing is that Syria is an incredibly complex country. It's something like 47 different ethnicities and religions, and it's clear that the society is pretty split. Assad does have support, mainly in the minority communities, Christian community and the Alawite community, but to a certain extent among the Kurds and among the Armenians, and there are Druze there. And there are places like Damascus and Aleppo in which the regime has a certain amount of support. It's not, I think, that they love Assad, because I don't think they do. I think the guy would lose an election if you had a vote there. But I think that what Syrians are very nervous about is they have seen what the result of the civil war was in Iraq. They absorbed 2 million refugees that came out of the U.S. invasion and the civil war in Iraq. They've had front row seats to the 15-year civil war in Lebanon. In fact, the polls show that they would like to have democracy and a free vote, and I don't think Assad would win it, but they don't want a civil war. And that just is not reflected anywhere. And I think because of that, the danger of that, is that now the United States has made a decision that it has to replace Assad. In other words, this recent decision 2 days ago that they're going to start aiding the opposition means that they're going for regime change. Well, if you're going to go for regime change, then it's a fight to the death. Only you've got a stalemate. So who's dying here? You know, not politicians in Washington. The people who are dying here are Syrians.
A New York Times piece on March 8th discussed the perils of U.S. military intervention in Syria in a way that I thought was a little odd. We have not seen a similar prominent New York Times piece about how things might be peacefully resolved. Your piece does try to get to a possible solution of the year-long Syrian crisis. I wonder if you could sum it up briefly.
Well, I think, you know, one thing, again, it's sort of what gets reported. And, you know, I read the Times very carefully this morning and my other news sources, and I did not see a report that Auxerre Française Presse has been running, which is that the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, is going to Cairo on Saturday to meet with Arab foreign ministers about Syria and what he calls the urgency of the crisis. And at the same time, the Chinese are sending a special delegation and the former ambassador to Damascus to Damascus to talk about some kind of political resolution of this situation. Now, these are seems to me to be two very important initiatives, and the Russians have already made a proposal that they will host a meeting between the opposition and the Assad government in Moscow. The Syrian opposition is opposed to this because they're demanding regime change. I mean, these are important developments here, and given that you have a stalemate, it seems to me the direction that you move in is that you look for some kind of political resolution. This is just not being reported. There's been no report that I have seen in any of the American press about the Cairo meeting with the Arab foreign ministers and the Russians or about this delegation from China. I think the problem here is that if you don't get that kind of reporting, then people look at it and they say, well, it's kind of hopeless. You know, in other words, this war is going on. You know, they bombed Homs, they took Homs, and now they're going on someplace else. The only resolution seems to be some kind of military resolution. In the meantime, there are a lot of important political developments which are going on and just not being reflected.
Well, we've seen this before where promising news about negotiations is out there, but it's not really reported. We've been speaking with Con Hallinan, former head of the journalism department at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and columnist for Foreign Policy and Focus, for which he wrote his latest column, Solving Syria Requires Separating Myth from Reality. Thanks for joining us today on Counterspin, Con Hallinan.
Thanks for having me.
A January New York Times story described in painful detail the punishment suffered by Chinese activist Ni Yulan at the hands of Chinese authorities. Beatings that left her unable to walk, time in jail, her law license revoked, the destruction of her family home. Only in passing and more than halfway through did the article mention why Ni had been targeted. She was using her legal expertise to help neighbors, quote, fighting eviction, part of the government's sweeping effort to remake the capital ahead of the Olympics, close quote. Well, more recently, the Times reported on resistance by Brazilians to evictions and home demolitions in advance of the 2016 Games in Rio de Janeiro, calling it a thorn in the side of the government. Seems these slum dwellers, as the Times describes them, are bedeviling the preparations for the big event. For corporate media, the Olympic Games rank high on the happy meter, as an article in Extra had it, somewhere around kittens and free beer. It doesn't lead to a lot of serious or sustained journalistic scrutiny. What would reporters find if they did look? We're joined now by Tom Tresser. He's an educator, consultant, and producer, and was a lead organizer with No Games Chicago, an all-volunteer grassroots effort that opposed Chicago's 2016 Olympic bid. He joins us now by phone from Chicago. Welcome to Counterspin, Tom Tresser.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, it's one thing to say that hosting the Olympics won't be the bonanza of civic enrichment and improvement that boosters, being boosters, confidently predict. But No Games Chicago and like-minded efforts, it seems, are really saying more than that. What are the reasons you think any city should rethink bidding to be an Olympic host?
In Chicago, Chicago, this process was driven by Mayor Daley, and it became his consuming passion for the last 2 years of his administration. He pretty much dropped out of running the city to attend to this. And the media and the business community and even, woefully, many nonprofits lined up behind this this march to ridiculousness. And so what No Games did is to look at the actual history of what happened in other cities going back as far as we could, looking at the public record, looking at academic studies. And we find that the games are part of a larger kind of scheme called mega projects. These are large, public-subsidized events, such as building football stadiums, which many cities are familiar with. And what happens is the private developers, private capital, have projects that can't be supported by the market, and they trump up, essentially, these events and say that they're going to have many, many great public benefits, just to basically suck from the public tit and take money out of our pockets to subsidize private gain. And in this case, it's just a fantastically large version of that same scheme. What they don't talk about is cost overruns, massive cost overruns. In Montreal in 76, they just finished paying for their games after 31 years debt. And the Chinese games were something like 20 billion pounds over budget, et cetera. So the record is filled with those kind of overruns. But the record is also filled with displacement. An organization in Geneva called the Center on Housing Rights and Evictions documented 1.2 million people displaced just from the Chinese games. So we've got the untold story of the games and these other massive projects that don't get talked about. And when we just looked into the public record, we were accused of being, you know, unpatriotic and Chicago haters, you know.
Right. Just to add a detail that I know you know, that Center on Housing Rights and Evictions, when they talked about those displacements, unsurprisingly, they found a disproportionate effect on poor people, on the homeless.
Right, because where the projects tend to be built are on the fringes of a city or in a part of a city that is considered, quote-unquote, blighted. Again, very, very loaded words. It's kind of like a mass hysteria. And essentially, your city is privatized for 7 years. In that New York Times article that you mentioned, there was a very interesting quote from a law professor in Rio. And this kind of, I think, takes it to the hilt here. He says, Brazilian law is adapting to carry out the games rather than the games adapting to fit the law.
That was actually one of my questions for you, because I know you have experience with the IOC and their accountability or lack thereof.
Yes, well, the IOC is almost like a private nation. It's quite an unusual entity in the world of what they call NGOs, non-governmental organizations. It's almost like a country. Their leadership have diplomatic status. The head of the IOC, President Roga, is a count, as addressed as Your Excellency. And of the, 103 Olympic members that were present when we were doing our work, 23 of them were actually members of the royalty. I mean, we're talking about princes of the blood, the Duke of Orange, for Christ's sake, the Sheikh of Abu Dhabi, you know, Her Royal Highness this and that. I mean, these are people that are so far removed from our experience as is, you know, we to ants, you know. And those are the people that run the IOC. It's a world's biggest brand, and it's an industry. It's a giant corporation, what it is, and they make their billions regardless of what happens in the particular host city.
Well, add to what you wanted to say about that Brazilian law professor's comment about the law adapting to carry out the games rather than the games to fit the law. Did you have more you wanted to say about that?
Well, just that, you know, I fight privatization here in the city. This is a massive thing happening all over the planet. If you think about the 99%, the 1% dialogue that's happening, this is just another example of strip mining the public sector for private good without public input. There was no discussion here in Chicago. There was no public dialogue about which way the city should be going into the 21st century. There was no discussion of what it means to have prosperity for everybody. It's just the same kind of transfer of wealth from the many to the few. And part of that is your laws are circumscribed and become superfluous. Now, in London and Vancouver, part of the Olympic package is essentially your city council becomes unnecessary. And in Vancouver, the city manager had the authority to pass new regulations and laws that would affect or impact or preserve the Olympic Games without having to have them voted on. So it becomes an extra legal procedure. And in fact, if the IOC doesn't like something in your Olympic package, even though it's been passed and vetted, for example, they decide that you need another 1,000 police. or what have you. You must comply. Mm-hmm. There's no you know, pushing back on them. And so I don't know about you, but I mean, I elected a mayor, I elect an alderman, I elect a state rep. I didn't elect anyone in Switzerland to run my city.
And when you talk about pushing through laws, this is where these civil liberties violations comes in.
What the Center on Housing Rights and Evictions and other Olympic organizers have documented around the globe is homelessness becomes criminalized, and there are sweeps of people that look homeless or who are undocumented or people who look black or who are young or who might be gang members or what have you. Massive sweeps of those people. They cannot tolerate this kind of spectacle anywhere near a living venue. So if you have young people congregating and they might be perceived as dangerous, well, they'll be swept away and it'll be sorted out later. And if there's any legal fees, you know, and damages, like in the city of Chicago is notorious for abusing civil liberties of protesters. We just settled $6 million on the protesters who were arrested illegally just a few years ago for an anti-war protest.
Mm-hmm.
That money comes from us. That's the taxpayers' dollar. So the mayor and the chief of police in these places, including Chicago, knowingly violate civil liberties, saying, well, you know, for the good of the moment, and then we'll sort it out later, and if we have to pay, well, it's the taxpayers who cover that cost.
Such an easy feel-good for the media, the Olympics are. It seems that reporters think, and you've touched on this, it's almost sacrilege to engage it as a story.
Oh, Lordy, Lordy. We found that media companies were actually giving cash and in-kind services to the Olympic Committee, the 2016 Committee. Many local media sources here were actually listed as donors of cash or in-kind services. So it's not surprising that you know, there's no interrogation. And even the foundation community gave money, MacArthur, the community trust, people that should have been giving to for homelessness and other kinds of human needs at the height of the financial meltdown when need was the greatest, they were donating. So there was a massive rah-rah-ism.
We've been speaking with Tom Tresser. You can find information about Olympics resistance at nogameschicago.com. Thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin, Tom Tresser.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information about FAIR, you can check out our website. It's fair.org. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media. With me is Steve Rendell. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.